May 26th, 1986, Frobisher Bay, Northwest Territories. After returning home from a trip, the sister of 15-year-old Marianne Birmingham enters the residence and discovers that Marianne has been stabbed to death. Months later, a local resident named Jopi Asitik pops up on the radar as a potential suspect after he is charged with the similar stabbing deaths of two other victims. Even though Asitik is initially charged with Marianne's murder, he denies any involvement, and the evidence is deemed insufficient for him to stand trial, so the crime is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week we're going to be returning to our podcast, Home Country of Canada, to do something a little different from the norm. We're going to be profiling the stories of nine missing and murdered Indigenous women from the Northwest Territories and Nunavut. As you probably know, earlier this year, The Trail Went Cold reached a milestone in which we managed to cover at least one cold case from all 50 American states. So I made it a goal to eventually do the same thing for every Canadian province and territory. And I'm pleased to say that on this episode, we're finally going to achieve that goal by covering cases from our country's two remaining territories, Nunavut and the Northwest Territories. Of course, there aren't a lot of cold cases to choose from in those territories, and the majority of them involve missing and murdered Indigenous women. And unfortunately, Canada has always had serious issues with the epidemic of violence against Indigenous women and the lack of attention their stories often receive from law enforcement and the media. This especially rings true for remote, sparsely populated regions like Nunavut and the Northwest Territories, as unsolved cold cases from there don't often receive a lot of mainstream coverage. As a result, there is just not that much information available about any of the featured cases on this episode, which is why I'm going to be profiling nine of them and exploring the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in general. In total, I'm going to be covering three cases from Nunavut and six from the Northwest Territories. I'll start off talking about the case I just mentioned in the intro, the 1986 murder of 15-year-old Marianne Birmingham, but I should throw in the disclaimer that even though it's technically considered to be a Nunavut case, Nunavut did not actually split off from the Northwest Territories and become its own independent territory until 1999. The location where this crime took place is now known as Nunavut's capital city of Iqaluit, but back in 1986, the city was called Frobisher Bay. I'll follow up Marianne's murder by briefly discussing two other cases from Nunavut, and then move on to the cases from the Northwest Territories, while providing whatever analysis I can for each of them as we go along. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all of that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the murder of Marianne Birmingham. Our story begins in 1986 in Frobisher Bay in the Northwest Territories, a town which had a population of just under 3,000 people at that point. and our central figure is a 15-year-old Anuk girl named Mary Ann Birmingham. Mary Ann is currently being raised by her mother, Sarah Birmingham, and has four siblings, though their father is no longer in the picture at this point. And even though Sarah has a boyfriend, he is currently incarcerated for domestic abuse. The youngest child in the family is an adopted 3-year-old boy named Lida, but he has been stricken with leukemia, so Sarah is forced to take him to Montreal, Quebec, in order to seek specialized treatment. Since the family's oldest sister, Elisapi, is now living in Ottawa, Ontario, Mary Ann's 17-year-old sister, Barbara, is put in charge of looking after her while their mother is gone. However, Barbara would soon receive a phone call from the Department of Social Services, informing her that the doctors were about to tell Sarah that there was nothing they could do for Lida, so they wanted Barbara to travel to Montreal in order to comfort her mother. Barbara agreed to make the trip, and would arrange for a family friend to check in on Mary Ann and their youngest sister while she was gone. After flying to Montreal, Barbara returned to Frobisher Bay on May the 26th, but when she arrived at their family's residence, she was surprised to discover that the front door was locked. Barbara proceeded to use her makeup case to pry open the window and enter the house, but when she went inside, she was horrified to find Mary Ann's body on the couch. She had been stabbed to death and mutilated. Since there was no phone at the family's residence, Barbara quickly went to a nearby house in order to call the police. It's never been specified how long Mary Ann had been dead before she was found, only that it was likely multiple days. After Sarah returned home for her daughter's funeral, she immediately had to return to Montreal to care for her son, and the family would suffer another tragedy when Lida lost his battle with leukemia and passed away after a 5-month hospital stay. Following the crime, benefactors from the local community put up a $10,000 reward for information, but within the next 6 months, a potential suspect would pop up on the radar. In November of that year, a local resident named Jopi Asitik was arrested and charged with the murders of 51-year-old Uliu Isiak and her 21-year-old son, Pudugu Isiak. Jopi and Pudugu were friends who worked together at the Frobisher Inn bar, and they celebrated Pudugu's 21st birthday by drinking alcohol and smoking dope. After they returned to Pudugu's residence to crash for the night, Jopi made the inexplicable decision to fatally stab Pudugu inside his bedroom, and he also disemboweled him while he was still alive. Since Pudugu was sleeping on the downstairs couch, Jopi proceeded to stab her to death as well. Afterwards, he took a taxi to a local restaurant, bought some marijuana, and walked to another friend's house to smoke it before he fell asleep. It wasn't long before Asitik was charged with both murders, and when he went on trial in 1988, his defense attorney tried to argue that Asitik was sleepwalking when he committed the crime and was not responsible for his actions. Asitik admitted his own culpability in the murders of Uliu and Pudugu and apologized for what he did, but his only explanation was that he had been struck with a quote-unquote urge to kill. His sleepwalking defense would not work, as the jury found Asitik guilty on 2 counts of second-degree murder, and he received a sentence of life imprisonment with eligibility for parole after 10 years. Since this crime contained a number of similarities to the stabbing death of Mary Ann Birmingham, Asitik was looked at as a potential suspect. In fact, at one point, Asitik was charged with Mary Ann's murder, but after a preliminary inquiry, a territorial court judge found that there was insufficient evidence to bring the case to trial. For his part, Asitik has continually denied being responsible for Mary Ann's death. Over the past 3 decades, he has been denied parole on numerous occasions and remains incarcerated at the Drumheller Institution in Alberta. No other potential suspects have been named in the crime, and after 32 years, the murder of Mary Ann Birmingham continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So before I talk any more about this case, I want to take a few moments to address the treatment of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada, which is a serious issue in this country. I've discussed this topic on previous podcast episodes I did about the murder of Amber Tuckerow, which took place in Alberta in 2010, and the unsolved disappearance of 5-year-old Tamara Keepness, which occurred in Saskatchewan in 2004. A few years ago, a national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls reached the conclusion that the country's widespread murders and disappearances amounted to a genocide and was a national crisis. In fact, the families of some of the victims profiled on this episode testified in front of the inquiry, but I'll get to that momentarily. I mentioned earlier that the cases I'm discussing here got very little media coverage, but it's frightening to think that there are many other cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous women, which we don't even know about because they got no coverage at all. Even though Indigenous women only comprise 4% of the total female population in Canada, the number of them who have become victims of crime is disproportionately high. A study showed that between 1980 and 2012, Indigenous women represented 16% of the female victims in reported homicide cases which occurred in Canada, and it's estimated that they represent about 10% of the country's total number of missing women. In 2014, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aka the RCMP, released a report titled Missing and Murdered Aboriginal Women, an Operational Overview, which concluded that over 1,000 Indigenous women had gone missing or were murdered within a 30-year period, though the actual number is believed to be much higher. This is what led to the formation of the National Inquiry, and in March of 2018, Mary Ann Birmingham's mother, Sarah Birmingham, would share her story for the first time in front of the Inquiry's commissioners at a public hearing in Montreal. Mary Ann's sister, Barbara Sevigny, would also speak in front of the commissioners and described the trauma of finding Mary Ann's body after she was murdered. By this point, Barbara was working as a trauma and addiction counselor and said that it took her years to realize that Mary Ann's death had caused her to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, as there was no system in place at the time to provide her or her family with the necessary mental health services they needed. This was an incredibly difficult time for Sarah Birmingham, as in addition to Mary Ann's murder, she also had to endure the loss of her 3-year-old son, Lyda, after a prolonged battle with leukemia. Even though she was only 17 years old at the time, Barbara essentially had to assume the responsibility of providing comfort for her mother and her other siblings, something she was not prepared for at that time. I'm sure it probably raised some eyebrows to hear that Mary Ann was left unsupervised at age 15 while Barbara traveled to Montreal, and only had a family friend to check in on her from time to time. But the family just did not have a strong support system in place, as Barbara stated that the only other option was to send Mary Ann to be watched over by her maternal grandmother, which she described as an unhealthy environment with a history of addictions and abuse. If Mary Ann had not been left alone, her murder may never have taken place, so you can definitely say that this crime was made possible by the numerous systemic issues that Indigenous families often have to face. Mary Ann's oldest sister, Alyssa P. Shudiepik, who was living in Ottawa at that time, has actually gone on to have a successful political career, as she served as the mayor of Iqaluit from 2003 until 2010, and was elected to the Legislative Assembly of Nunavut in 2017. Alyssa P. has publicly stated that RCMP detachments in Canada's territories often have issues with young, inexperienced officers and high turnover rates, which is why cold cases such as Mary Ann's murder are not investigated properly. She has called for the federal government to offer better funding to the territory's police services and introduce initiatives to combat underlying issues from the region, such as a chronic lack of housing and trauma counseling. Barbara has also publicly expressed her frustration about the lack of updates her family has received about Mary Ann's case from the RCMP, stating, quote, "I've really lost trust in the system. It would be nice for the families to not have to call in and say, I would like an update," end quote. As for the crime itself, there are very few details about Mary Ann's murder which have been made available publicly. We only know that she was found stabbed to death and mutilated, but it's never been confirmed if she was sexually assaulted. The only person who has popped up on the radar as a potential suspect is Jopi Asiktik, because he fatally stabbed two other victims in a similar fashion months later. It's unclear how much, if any, evidence linked Asiktik to Mary Ann's case, but it was deemed insufficient enough to bring him to trial. On a side note, there is also limited information available about Asiktik's murders of Ulugu and Putugu Isiak, but the case became the subject of controversy in 2003, following the release of a Canadian made-for-TV movie titled Sleep Murder, which was loosely based on this crime. It starred Jason Priestley of Beverly Hills 90210 fame as a defense attorney who represents an Inuk man who is charged with killing his adoptive mother and brother, but claims he has no memory of the crime. Since the perpetrator does not have any prior history of violence, Priestley's defense is that he only committed the murders while experiencing a serious sleep disorder and is not responsible for his actions. Of course, the Siddiq's defense attorney tried to mount a sleepwalking defense at his trial, which did not work, but the real-life victim's family felt that sleep murder exploited their tragedy by portraying its fictional killer as a gentle, sympathetic figure who had no control over what he did. Indeed, a Siddiq fully admitted that he killed Uliu and Pudugu for reasons he could not explain, and he even apologized for it, yet he has always denied any involvement in Marianne's murder. This could be taken as a sign that a Siddiq did not kill her, but it's worth noting that even though a Siddiq received a life sentence for the other two murders, even Canada's worst offenders generally do not receive life imprisonment without any possibility of parole. Well, a Siddiq has been denied parole on multiple occasions, and the chances of him walking out of prison are very slim, he still isn't quite in the position of having nothing left to lose. If a Siddiq was responsible for Marianne's murder, he might believe that admitting to it will completely kill his chances of ever being released, which is why he has elected to stay silent. I see no indication that a Siddiq knew Marianne, and I have no idea what motive he might have had for murdering her, but his motive for murdering the Isiak seemed to be nothing more than a quote-unquote urge to kill, so I guess anything's possible. It is interesting that when Barbara returned home and discovered Marianne's body, the residence front door was locked, and it does not sound like there were any signs of forced entry. I guess it's possible that Marianne's killer was someone she knew, and she willingly invited them inside before she was murdered, but since there's so little information available, we can only speculate. Since DNA profiling was not yet a standard investigative tool in criminal cases back in 1986, I'm not sure if any DNA evidence exists in this case. But if it does, then perhaps someday it will lead directly to the perpetrator. If it turns out that a Siddiq was the killer all along, then at least we know that he's already locked up and won't harm anyone else. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Mary Ann Birmingham, please contact the Iqaluit Detachment of the RCMP at 867-979-0123. That's 867-979-0123. So now I want to talk about two more cases from Nunavut, which are listed on the official Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women website. Our first victim is 38-year-old Tabitha Kalouk, a mother of six who was found dead inside a residence on Christmas Day in 2002. Tabitha lived in the Inuit hamlet of Resolute Bay, which is located on Cornwallis Island and is one of Canada's northernmost communities. The case has been investigated by both the Resolute Bay and Iqaluit detachments of the RCMP, but even though it's technically considered to be open, it has also been described as quote-unquote borderline, since no one can be certain if Tabitha's death was a homicide or suicide. The autopsy found traces of battery acid and gasoline antifreeze in Tabitha's blood, but since there's virtually no other information available about this case, I have no idea if she personally ingested this or if she might have been poisoned by a third party. However, Tabitha's family definitely believed that she was a victim of foul play, as they described her as someone who feared death and never would have taken her own life. Investigators have acknowledged that Tabitha's death is suspicious, but they have never been able to garner enough evidence to prove that a homicide took place and there are no suspects. Unfortunately, there's really nothing else I can say about this story, but Resolute Bay is about as remote a community as you can get and considered to be one of the coldest inhabited places in the entire world. So if Tabitha's death really was a suicide and she elected to end her own life in this fashion, then that might point to major systemic issues within the region. Our second Nunavut case took place in Iqaluit in 2008, and the victim was 46-year-old Della Utuva, who went by the name Jochebed. At the time, Jochebed was attending Nunavut Arctic College while working as an interpreter at the health center, and she lived with her common-law spouse, Amosi Utuva, who went by the name Amos, as well as their two children. On June the 7th, Amos called for help and summoned medical assistance to the residence because Jochebed was not breathing, but shortly after she was rushed to the hospital, Jochebed was pronounced dead. After a toxicology report was performed, it was ruled that Jochebed had consumed a lethal amount of alcohol, but her family believed she was the victim of foul play. Amos had a criminal record and was known for being abusive towards Jochebed, and her family believed that a drinking party took place at the residence in which things escalated to the point where Amos fatally beat her. On June the 9th, 2 days after Jochebed's death, Amos was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. But after police consulted with the Public Prosecution Service of Canada and the investigating pathologist who conducted Jochebed's autopsy, the charges wound up being stayed and Amos was released from custody. However, police confirmed that the charges had not been dropped and they had 1 year to reactivate Amos's charges if new evidence surfaced. Amos subsequently left Iqaluit and moved to the hamlet of Pond Inlet with his two children, where he soon became involved in a relationship with another woman named Susie Powadiluk. While much to the disappointment of Jochebed's family, her full coroner's report was not released until May of 2009, nearly a full year after she died. It showed significantly less ethanol in Jochebed's blood than the original toxicology report, and it was not considered to be a lethal amount. Most importantly, the report showed that Jochebed had blunt force trauma injuries to her torso, face, back, arms, and legs, as well as bite marks on her arms. She also had an undiagnosed heart condition called atherosclerotic coronary artery disease, where a small amount of plaque limited blood flow through one of the arteries in her heart. This meant that strenuous activity or stress, such as a violent physical assault, could cause a sudden cardiac death. If Amos assaulted Jochebed, this meant that even if he did not intend to kill her, his actions directly caused her to die. However, by the time the coroner's report was released, charges could no longer be filed against Amos. 4 months earlier, on January the 16th, Amos was killed by his new spouse, Susie Powadiluk. There are very few details about the circumstances of Amos's death, only that it involved, quote-unquote, an assault with a weapon, but even though Susie was charged with manslaughter, the charges wound up being stayed. It does not sound like the charges were ever reactivated, so it would not surprise me at all if Amos's death was ruled to be self-defense because he was violent and abusive towards Susie. Needless to say, Jochebed's family was none too pleased that a coroner's report was not released until months after Amos's death. Given the evidence, I think it's safe to say that Amos violently attacked Jochebed and the stress of the situation caused her heart to stop. But since Amos was killed before he could face justice, Jochebed's case is still officially considered to be unsolved, and there's really not much else that can be done. I know that Jochebed and Amos had two children together, and while their current whereabouts are unknown, I hope they're doing okay today, as I'm sure that losing both parents in a violent fashion within a 6 month span must have been traumatic. In February of 2018, Jochebed's sister-in-law, Sophie Nashuk, spoke in front of commissioners from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Women and Girls at a public hearing in Rankin Inlet. Sophie said that one of the major systemic issues which led to Jochebed's death was the lack of resources available for Indigenous women in Nunavut who suffer through domestic abuse. Since the region is so remote, women who are trapped in abusive relationships often do not have anywhere to go. Sadly, it sounds like the situation led to a tragic end for Jochebed, and while she may never receive full justice for what happened to her, at least her family can use her story to speak out and hopefully lead to the implementation of some positive changes for Indigenous women. So now we're going to move on by discussing some unsolved cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous females from the Northwest Territories. I'm going to start off by discussing four cold cases which took place between 1988 and 1991, as the RCMP has explored the possibility that all of these victims might have fallen prey to a serial killer. Our first victim is 18-year-old Leona May Brulé, who hailed from Fort Providence, a hamlet located in the South Slave region of the Northwest Territories. In 1988, Leona moved to the capital city of Yellowknife, where she was employed by her sister as a live-in nanny for her 2-year-old niece, and she often sewed outfits and toys for the child. Leona had a boyfriend in Edmonton, Alberta, and would often hitchhike back and forth in order to visit him there. Leona was last seen in Yellowknife in September of that year, and since she was known for living a transient lifestyle and picking up and leaving without notice, her absence did not immediately cause concern. Details are murky, but the last time Leona was confirmed to be alive was when she made contact with one of her cousins in Edmonton on March the 15th, 1989. In spite of her transient lifestyle, Leona generally did keep in touch with family and friends, but after not hearing from her daughter in over a year, Leona's mother, Ernestine Brulé, contacted the Fort Providence Detachment of the RCMP to report her missing in October of 1989. During the 1990s, there were unconfirmed reports of Leona being seen living on the streets of Edmonton, but there has been no activity on her health and social insurance numbers. The only major lead in this case occurred when Leona's aunt, Catherine Sanderson, received an envelope postmarked from Florida, which contained a newspaper clipping about a weight loss program. The clipping had a handwritten note scribbled on it about how Catherine should use the program, and since she was overweight at the time, Catherine suspected that Leona might have written the note. Unfortunately, there have been no further developments in the investigation. According to everyone who knew her, Ernestine Brulé became a very reserved person who almost never went out, as she would always wait by the phone on the off chance that her daughter attempted to call her. Tragically, Ernestine passed away without receiving any answers about what happened. The next victim we're going to discuss is 15-year-old Charlene Candace Catholic, who was a member of an indigenous group known as the Dene and lived in Lutsilke, a First Nations community located in the North Slave region near the eastern end of Great Slave Lake. When she was 12 years old, Charlene lost her mother to cancer and would be raised by her father, Joe Catholic, as well as her aunt Lorraine and her grandmother. On July the 18th, 1990, Charlene and her cousin Bev flew from Lutsilke to Yellowknife in order to attend the Dene National Assembly in the nearby First Nations community of Deta. They spent the next 4 days staying with one of their aunts and were scheduled to fly back home on July the 21st, but when they went to Yellowknife Airport that day, Charlene and Bev discovered that a booking mix-up had taken place, which would prevent both of them from boarding the return flight. As a result, Bev wound up taking the flight alone, while Charlene remained in Yellowknife. Details of what happened next are sketchy, but it's been reported that Charlene was next seen at an arcade on Franklin Avenue, where she met up with an older man and a male teenager. She wound up traveling with them to the community of Ray, which is located 110 kilometers northwest of Yellowknife and has since been renamed Pechoco. While there, Charlene attended a party with some other teenagers and spent the night, and while she planned to travel back to Yellowknife on July the 22nd, Charlene's friends had no luck finding her a ride. The story goes that an acquaintance of Charlene's saw her attempting to hitchhike at the intersection of Highway 3 and the Ray Access Road. The acquaintance said they had to be somewhere, but told Charlene to stay put because they would come back to pick her up and give her a ride. However, by the time the acquaintance returned a short time later, Charlene was gone, and she has never been heard from again. She was subsequently reported missing to the RCMP, but one of the only developments in the investigation involved Roy Dahl, a reporter for the Native Press who had written about Charlene's disappearance when it originally happened. By the summer of 1996, Dahl was working for the Yellowknife radio station CKLB when he received a phone call from an anonymous male who said, quote, "Charlene's been found," before he hung up. When Dahl contacted the RCMP, they advised him to record the call if the man ever phoned back, but he never did. Over the years, Charlene's family have openly expressed their frustration with the RCMP's investigation. Her father, Joe, claimed they did not communicate with him at all, and that trying to convince them to look for Charlene was like, quote-unquote, talking to a wall. Joe often spent his own money traveling to various locations, some as far away as the United States, in order to hang up missing posters and search for his daughter, but tragically, he passed away without receiving any answers. During one of his final interviews, Joe stated that he had essentially given up on going to the police to discuss Charlene's case, and had not spoken with them since 2008. Charlene's aunt, Lorraine Catholic, has since become the family's official spokesperson, and even though Lorraine is a former RCMP officer, she says she has never been granted access to the case file. In June of 2017, the Supreme Court of the Northwest Territories issued an order stating that there was reasonable grounds to presume Charlene was dead and had her declared legally deceased, so her case is now considered to be a homicide investigation instead of a missing persons investigation. Our next story takes place in 1990 and involves 24-year-old Mary Rose Kijuk, who hails from the hamlet of Coppermine, which would later be renamed Kaluktuk when Nunavut split off from the Northwest Territories years later. Mary Rose has a 4-year-old son named Nathan, but her parents agreed to look after him so that Mary Rose could travel to Yellowknife in order to attend Aurora College. At this point, she is in her second year of studies in social work and living with friends at the Gold Range Hotel. The exact circumstances of how Mary Rose went missing are murky, but she was apparently last seen at the hotel's bar on June the 28th. Unfortunately, Mary Rose was not officially reported missing to the RCMP until September the 13th of that year, and when investigators checked the hotel room where she had been staying, they discovered that she had left most of her personal items behind, including her purse and her prescription eyeglasses, which she desperately needed to see. Some sources have reported that Mary Rose was believed to be 4 months pregnant at the time she disappeared, but the RCMP has since stated that this is unconfirmed. There would be few developments in the investigation until 2003, when a person walking their dog came across a human bone fragment near the Con Mine, a former gold mine located just south of Yellowknife. The bone fragment was sent to the University of Alberta for examination, and while they concluded that it likely belonged to a petite woman in her 20s, all attempts to extract DNA from it were unsuccessful. However, the RCMP eventually decided to send the bone to another lab in Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina, which was operated by the International Commission on Missing Persons. The lab did manage to extract a partial DNA profile from the bone, and in February of 2018, it was announced that when the profile was compared to a database of DNA samples which were obtained from the families of missing individuals, it wound up being a match to Mary Rose. A search of the area surrounding the Con Mine failed to turn up any additional human remains, but this did provide conclusive confirmation that Mary Rose was deceased. Mary Rose's son Nathan now has a daughter of his own whom he named after his mother, but he has also openly expressed his disappointment with the lack of communication he has received from the RCMP. The only contact Nathan ever had with them was when they asked for a sample of his DNA, but even though investigators assured him that they would keep him informed about his mother's case, he only learned about the DNA match to the bone fragment after reading the news on Facebook. Our fourth victim in this series of cases is 17-year-old Mariella Lenny, who was a member of the Fort Slavey tribe and hailed from the hamlet of Fort Norman, which was later renamed Tulia. During the fall of 1991, Mariella had a 4-month-old baby, but much like Mary Rose Kijuk, her parents agreed to look after the child so that she could travel to Yellowknife to attend high school. Mariella initially stayed with her aunt, Bertha Lenny, before she moved in with one of her cousins, but it sounds like she stopped attending school and would stay out late at night partying with the wrong crowd. The last time Mariella was confirmed to be alive was when she was seen leaving a Discovery Inn in downtown Yellowknife at around 6 p.m. on October the 6th, but it would be 12 days before she was reported missing. 7 months later, on May the 8th, 1992, Mariella's body was found floating next to a dock in Yellowknife Bay. The location was near the Con Mine area and in fairly close proximity to where Mary Rose's bone fragment would be discovered 11 years later. Due to the state of decomposition, Mariella's face was unrecognizable and she had to be identified with dental records. Even though Mariella's body was partially clad and missing a shoe, police were unable to determine if she had been sexually assaulted. While they could not figure out her exact cause of death, investigators believe she was the victim of a homicide. While very few details have been released to the public, there was apparently evidence at the scene to indicate that Mariella was killed there before her body was tossed into the water. In January of 2018, Mariella's Aunt Bertha spoke in front of commissioners from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls at a public hearing in Yellowknife. She revealed that investigators allowed her to view the medical report about her niece's death, and while it pretty much ruled out the possibility that Mariella was shot or stabbed, they could not tell if she was still alive when her body was tossed into the water. Anyway, the previous four cold cases I just described initially did not receive much media attention until November of 1993, when the RCMP announced that they were reopening the cases and looking into possible connections between them. Given that all four victims were young Indigenous females, and their disappearances had ties to the Yellowknife area, can Leona Brule, Charlene Catholic, Mary Rose Kijuk, and Mariella Lenny all have been the victim of a serial killer? Well, I certainly can't discount that possibility, but there's no conclusive evidence to link all these crimes together. Personally, I'd say that the two cases which were most likely to be connected are Mary Rose Kijuk and Mariella Lenny, since they were both last seen in downtown Yellowknife and Mariella's body and Mary Rose's bone fragment were found in close proximity to each other in the Caen mine area. The issue with linking their deaths to the disappearances of Leona Brulé and Charlene Catholic is that they were not even in the Yellowknife area when they went missing. In fact, we technically can't even pinpoint a specific time and location when Leona was last seen, because even though she was working in Yellowknife, she was believed to be hitchhiking towards Edmonton, and her last known communication was when she contacted a relative there. Since she was known for living a transient lifestyle and picking up and moving at a moment's notice, Leona was not even officially reported missing until about a year after she was last seen. And since there were unconfirmed sightings of her living on the streets of Edmonton, Leona could have been alive for years after the report was filed. For all we know, she could have gotten herself involved in drugs and sex work, and if she passed away at any point these past 3 decades, she might be an unidentified Jane Doe somewhere. Obviously, the big wild card in this case is Leona's former boyfriend, as she would often hitchhike all the way from Yellowknife to Edmonton in order to visit him. The boyfriend's identity has never been released publicly, and there are no details about him or his relationship with Leona, so I have no idea if he was ever looked at as a potential suspect. It's unclear if Leona was traveling to Edmonton at the time she went missing, but it's a very long commute, as it takes 15 hours to drive there from Yellowknife. If Leona was hitchhiking, I doubt too many motorists would have been willing to drive the full 15 hours, meaning that she likely needed to hitch rides with multiple people in order to make the trip. And unfortunately, this only increases the possibility that Leona might have crossed paths with someone who murdered her, and there is a lot of remote, empty space between Yellowknife and Edmonton to dispose of her body. If Leona did contact one of her cousins in March of 1989, then that means she was alive for around 6 months after she left Yellowknife, and the only major clue in the investigation is the strange envelope that was mailed to her Aunt Catherine from Florida. As you recall, it contained a newspaper clipping about a weight loss program with a handwritten note advising Catherine to use the program in order to lose weight. I have no idea if Catherine knew anyone in Florida at that time, but if she didn't, then I can see why she would be inclined to believe that Leona sent it. But if that's the case, how did Leona wind up all the way in Florida? Of course, if she died down there and is currently a Jane Doe, then it might be a challenge to connect her to a missing persons case from the Northwest Territories. There really isn't much else I can say about this case, but the good news is that Leona's story was featured on a 2018 episode of the Canadian true crime TV series, Taken. The show airs on the Aboriginal People's Television Network and focuses on cold cases involving female Indigenous victims, so if the right person watches Leona's episode, then perhaps someday they will come forward with information about what happened to her. So now we'll move on to Charlene Catholic's disappearance, who went missing during a trip to Yellowknife, but was last seen hitchhiking outside the community of Ray, 110 kilometers away. And what's troubling is that Charlene was only 15 years old at that time, and would have been particularly vulnerable if the wrong person offered her a ride. The story goes that when Charlene couldn't board her flight back home the previous day, she went to an arcade in downtown Yellowknife and met up with an older man and a teenager who took her to a party in Ray, but no one could provide her with a ride back, which is why she resorted to hitchhiking. And she was apparently seen by an acquaintance on Highway 3, who said they would return to pick Charlene up, but by the time they got back, Charlene was gone, as she may have already climbed into a vehicle with someone else. It's possible that Charlene crossed paths with a predator who murdered her and disposed of her body, but her Aunt Lorraine has made a few comments to the media which make me wonder if there might be more to this story. In one interview, Lorraine stated this about her niece, quote, "She was a very mature, responsible young lady. She knew she was involved in a relationship she shouldn't have been," end quote. Unfortunately, no further details were provided, but does this mean Charlene was involved in an inappropriate relationship in her home community of Lutsokay? Or did this play a role in her decision to travel to Ray to attend a party? Lorraine has also expressed her belief that somebody in Ray, which is now known as Bachoco, knows exactly what happened to Charlene, and she thinks that people in Yellowknife might know something as well. There have apparently been rumors that Charlene was spotted in places like Vancouver and North Dakota, but the RCMP never followed up on these leads. So could this mean that Charlene was not murdered and was instead picked up by someone who forced her into sex work? With so little evidence to work with, it's tough to know for certain what happened. It's also worth noting that when the final report of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls was released in 2019, they made reference to the unsolved 1990 disappearance of a teenage girl in the Northwest Territories, which has had over a dozen lead investigators and upwards of 250 investigators in total. While the report never actually referred to the missing girl by name, there's a good chance it was Charlene, and this would probably go a long way towards explaining the lack of progress in the investigation and the communication issues with her family. Indeed, I mentioned earlier on in this episode that one of the biggest obstacles to solving cold case in Canada's territories is that their RCMP detachments often have a high turnover rate. However, in July of 2020, on the 30th anniversary of Charlene's disappearance, the Northwest Territory RCMP's Historical Case Unit did announce that they were still investigating the case, so at least it hasn't been completely forgotten. So as for the murders of Mary Rose Kijuk and Mariella Lenny, I do think there's a decent chance they might be connected, but very little information has been released publicly, and I'm sure the respective investigations were hampered by the fact that the victims were not reported missing for a considerable amount of time after they were last seen. But I certainly would not rule out the possibility that they were both murdered by the same individual who subsequently used the Con Mine area as a dumping ground for their bodies. What's particularly sad about these cases is that Mary Rose and Mariella each hailed from tiny remote hamlets in the middle of nowhere, and their families agreed to look after their children so they could travel to Yellowknife and further their education. But instead, they wound up being killed. It's also possible that Mary Rose became pregnant again, though this has never been officially confirmed, and since all they found of her was one small bone fragment, we may never know for certain. But if this is true, then Mary Rose's killer not only murdered her, but her unborn child as well. I do have to give the RCMP credit for not giving up on identifying Mary Rose's bone fragment, because even though the initial attempts to extract DNA from it were unsuccessful, they did take the initiative to send it to a lab in Sarajevo for more advanced testing. But even so, they still displayed their ongoing issues with communicating with the victims' families, since Mary Rose's son Nathan had to learn the news about her death by reading about it on social media. However, even though the rest of Mary Rose's remains have never been found, at least her family now knows for certain that she is deceased, and I hope that both they and Mariella's loved ones can receive answers someday. So now we're going to talk about two more cold cases involving Indigenous women from Yellowknife, but unfortunately, there's virtually no information available about the first case. The victim was a 39-year-old Chippewa woman and mother of five named Dorothy Georgina Abel, who suffered a brutal assault in Yellowknife in July of 1996. Dorothy wound up being transported to the Royal Alexander Hospital at Edmonton, where she remained in a coma for the next 4 years before she passed away. Over a decade later, when the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls was launched, Dorothy's family contacted the RCMP and attempted to obtain the original records of the investigation into her death, but learned that they had gone missing or been destroyed. I have no idea if Dorothy's loved ones or the authorities have any idea who might be responsible for assaulting her and causing her death, but it does not sound like a serious investigation was ever performed, and the fact that the original records no longer exist is pretty outrageous. I wish I could say more about Dorothy's story, but sadly, that's literally all the information there is. It really makes you wonder how many unsolved cold cases there are involving missing and murdered Indigenous women, which we don't even know about because the official records no longer exist, meaning that the victims have been lost to history. But thankfully, the final case we're going to discuss did receive a decent amount of exposure, and like the Leona Brulé disappearance, this story was also the subject of an episode of the Canadian true crime series, Taken. The victim in question was a 22-year-old Inuk woman named Angela Meyer, who lived in Yellowknife and was the second youngest of four children to her parents, Dean and Kathy Meyer. At the age of 15, Angela started developing symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which affected her life so much that she was unable to complete high school. Over the next several years, Angela took a number of different medications for treatment, but some of them caused her to gain weight and develop type 2 diabetes. Even though Angela was known for being a very loving person who liked to hug people, the medications would sometimes cause her to lash out with violent outbursts. In spite of this, she was able to access an independent living program and resided in a number of different group homes. She also found success when she competed in the Yellowknife Special Olympics during the spring of 2010 and won Athlete of the Year. However, Angela's violent episodes eventually became too much for the staff of the independent living program to deal with, so she was transferred to the psychiatric ward at Stanton Territorial Hospital, where she remained an inpatient. Since Angela's family were not eligible for health care benefits, her mother Kathy took out an advance from her employer in order to pay for a psychological assessment for her daughter. It was concluded that Angela would not be able to receive the treatment she required in Yellowknife, so plans were made to transfer her to an independent living center in Edmonton. Since Kathy worked for an airline, she would be able to get passes for her family to fly down there and visit Angela frequently. On Friday, November the 26th, Angela was days away from making the move to Edmonton and was given a 24-hour pass from the hospital. She was released under the legal guardianship of her mother, and after going out to dinner with her family, Angela spent the night at their home on 54th Street. The following afternoon, Angela was scheduled to return to the hospital, but her family decided that they were going to go there and sign her out for an additional day. At 1:15 p.m., Angela stepped outside the house to smoke a cigarette on the porch, but 5 minutes later, her family noticed she was gone. Kathy became concerned enough to contact the hospital, but they advised her to wait a few hours until around 5 o'clock before phoning the police in case Angela returned. However, the temperatures that day would dip below 20 degrees Celsius, and Angela was not dressed appropriately for the weather, as she was wearing yoga pants and did not have gloves or a hat. She also only had enough insulin, antidepressants, and antipsychotic medication to last the weekend, and she did not take any of it with her when she left, so Kathy became concerned enough to contact the Yellowknife RCMP to officially report Angela missing. It turned out there were multiple eyewitness sightings of Angela that afternoon, including one woman who claimed that Angela asked her for a cigarette and appeared to be disoriented. During the early evening hours, Angela walked directly inside the residence of a couple she did not know, and when the homeowner asked her if she was okay, she abruptly left. The resident proceeded to follow Angela down the road in his car while contacting the RCMP on his cell phone, but he soon lost her, and he said he last saw Angela heading towards a wooded area outside of town. Now, when Angela was last seen at a residence, she was wearing a white Helly Hansen jacket, but it would later be found inside an apartment on Ptarmigan Road, where Angela had previously resided while she was part of the independent living program. Since a red and black 2008 Arctic Winter Games volunteer jacket was missing, it was suspected that Angela had gone inside and switched coats. Well, sure enough, an Arctic Winter Games jacket matching that description was eventually found outside Yellowknife near Tin Can Hill. This led to fear that Angela removed the jacket before she wandered into the woods and died of exposure, but multiple searches of the area failed to turn up any trace of her, and Angela has not been seen in over a decade. When commissioners from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls held a public hearing in Yellowknife in January of 2018, Angela's family took the opportunity to speak with them. Unlike many of these other victims' families, the Myers generally had praise for the Yellowknife RCMP and how they handled their investigation into Angela's case, but they were frustrated by the RCMP's reluctance to perform DNA testing on the Arctic Winter Games jacket which had been found. The Myers felt that it would prove with absolute certainty if the jacket belonged to Angela, and if someone else's DNA turned up there, then this would point towards someone else being involved in her disappearance. The Yellowknife RCMP have never performed the testing, and even though the Myers wanted to take the jacket to a private lab and pay for the testing themselves, they were warned that any evidence which turned up would not be admissible in court. Not surprisingly, the Myers also used Angela's disappearance to raise the issue of the lack of mental health care support for Indigenous residents in northern Canada. When Angela began struggling with schizophrenia, she saw several different doctors and psychiatrists who often provided conflicting information, and each one would change her medications. In fact, one psychiatrist even told the Meyer family that he believed Angela was faking her condition. There was one psychiatrist that Angela seemed to be doing very well with, but he eventually retired and moved out of the area without anyone replacing him, so it was very difficult for Angela to receive consistent care, since the Northwest Territories just did not have the necessary resources in place to treat Angela. This is why the decision was made to send her to an independent living center in Edmonton. It was speculated that this upcoming move may have prompted Angela to run away on her own, but according to her family, she was apparently looking forward to it. Since Angela had a previous history of wandering off on multiple occasions, and the last eyewitness who saw her described her as being disoriented, I think it's most likely that Angela was just hit with the sudden urge to take off during that 5-minute window while she was out on the porch and no one was watching her. If she became confused, that might explain why she went to her former apartment and changed jackets, as this may have instinctively been the first location that popped into her mind. This is definitely a very tragic story, as it sounds like Angela had a very loving family who would have done anything to help her cope with her mental health issues, but she just happened to live in a region without the necessary resources in place. This is the same issue which has hampered the police investigations into these various cases I covered, as they often lack the proper funding and are forced to deal with a high turnover rate. Given that it was a cold winter day, and Angela was underdressed for the weather, I think the most likely explanation is that she wandered into a wooded area and died of exposure, and her remains simply haven't been found. While the location where the jacket turned up has been searched on numerous occasions, it's very easy for human remains to be missed. Of course, I guess we can't completely discount the possibility that Angela crossed paths with an unknown third party who subsequently abducted and murdered her, so I do wish the Yellowknife RCMP would agree to have DNA testing performed on the jacket. If it turned up unknown traces of DNA which did not belong to Angela, then this might lend credence to the idea that she was the victim of foul play. I'm not sure if this is just a budgetary issue, but this is the same law enforcement agency who took the initiative to send Mary Rose Kijuk's bone fragment to a lab in Sarajevo for advanced DNA testing. I'm guessing that investigators are inclined to believe that Angela wandered off and died of exposure, and do not believe that testing the jacket is worth the time or resources. But until Angela can be found, we cannot rule anything out. So that about brings an end to our special episode about missing and murdered Indigenous women from Northern Canada. And now our podcast has officially achieved its goal of covering at least one cold case from every Canadian province and territory. In total, we've profiled 9 unsolved cold cases on this episode, 6 from the Northwest Territories and 3 from Nunavut. 6 of these victims were murdered or died under suspicious circumstances, and 3 of them are still missing. In some of these stories, we had a decent amount of information to discuss, but in others, there was almost nothing. And while a couple of these cases are still being actively investigated, many of them have not received nearly as much attention as they deserve, both from law enforcement and the media. But at the very least, discussing what happened to these 9 victims has provided some insight into the major systemic issues that Indigenous victims often have to face in Canada, and why so many of them remain unsolved. Since we only cover Nunavut and the Northwest Territories, we barely scratched the surface of how many other cases there are in Canada which are just like this, and there is a good chance I may revisit this topic sometime down the line. If you happen to have information about any of the 9 cases I've profiled on this episode, there are 2 main resources you can contact. The cases from the Northwest Territories are being investigated by the RCMP's Historical Case Unit, who can be reached at 867-669-1111. That's 867-669-1111. But for any of these cases from the Northwest Territories or Nunavut, you can contact the Canadian Crime Stoppers Association at 1-800-222-8477. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode in which I did something a little different from the norm and listed my top 10 favorite movies that were based on true crimes. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, covered yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1986 murder of Chaim Weiss. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, Jay Chips. Thank you so much for your support. We also wanted to mention that in conjunction with the subject matter of this episode, The Trail Went Cold is making donations to a pair of Canadian organizations that provide support to Indigenous women. One of them is the Native Women's Association of Canada, which can be found at the website nwac.ca. And the other is Amnesty International's No More Stolen Sisters program. If any of you would like to make donations to either or both of these organizations, we will be providing links to their websites in our show notes. So before I bring this episode to a close, I wanted to play a promo for a new true crime podcast called Campus Killings.
Fall is here and class is back in session. It's a busy time for students and faculty, and with a new school year comes new adventures, new experiences, and new goals to achieve.
But as much promise and excitement as the fall semester brings, there can also be a dark side to it, one in which the unthinkable can happen. I'm Amy Slashberg.
And I'm Megan Sachs. And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings.
As educators and criminologists, we teach, research, write, and podcast about victims, offenders, and the issues that surround our criminal justice system.
Amy and I have both worked in the field of criminal justice for 20 years, myself in law enforcement and Amy in the mental health field.
In Campus Killings, we'll dive into some of the most shocking and tragic murders to happen on school grounds, and we'll provide our analysis on the cases we cover as both educators and trained criminologists.
We'll discuss what went wrong and what could have been done differently to prevent the tragic outcome. Campus Killings is available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Subscribe now so you don't miss a single episode of Campus Killings.
I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.